The end of December last year, 2021, I fell ill to the coronavirus. I caught it from a former employer at a business meeting that I really didn't want to go to. About 3 days after the meeting, I started feeling a bit off, sort of like I was coming down with the flu. It progressively got worse, and I was completely bedridden by the second or third day after showing symptoms. So anyone who has had COVID-19 knows that it ranges from being relatively mild to life-threatening. I ran a fever between 102 to 104 degrees for about 3 weeks. I had a headache that would never cease, and I was delirious most of the time. During this time, I refused to even entertain the idea that I had COVID for the first week, latching on to the idea that it was just this regular season flu that I was battling. That proved to not be the case. Being around family members, I'd managed to infect both of my parents as well as my brother, and each of us had different symptoms and severity. But my father had gotten the absolute worst out of the four of us. He began showing symptoms a week after myself, though his were quite different than my own. This is all very fuzzy in my memory because while he was fighting through this, I was still in a delirium myself. I was fighting excruciatingly painful headaches and a high fever. To make matters worse, my mother and brother are also now battling COVID, so no one could really take care of each other or keep a watchful eye on anyone else. Around day 8 of Dad being symptomatic, he began to hyperventilate, and his breathing rapidly deteriorated over the next 3 days. My aunt had asked my mother what his oxygen saturation levels were. To this point, none of us had even really considered measuring oxygen saturation. Dad had just purchased an oximeter about a month or two ago from this point for completely unrelated reasons, and the oximeter showed 44% when we measured them. Now, to give you an idea of what that means, a healthy person should be between 95% and 100% oxygen saturation. His fingernails were turning blue, and he couldn't stand up. And at that point, I decided we needed to call 911. It was uncharted territory for all of us. What was something that we casually would read about in the news was becoming a reality for us. It never seems real until it is real. We've heard the horror stories of people going to the hospital with COVID and dying on ventilators. Less than 50% chance of survival once the ventilator is used. That's what the nurse told me. And I think she was being generous. A situation like this is terrifying. Your brain doesn't work. You don't know what to do. You don't know what to say. It's the highest of stakes, life or death. Yet as I got on my knees to pray, the words just wouldn't come out. I didn't have any words. Mumbled, rambled. There was a lot of tears. And it's times like these that the Holy Spirit makes intercession for us, as we read in Romans 8, verse 26. You don't need to turn there, but I'll go ahead and read it. Romans 8, 26. Likewise, the Spirit also helps our infirmities, for we know not what we should pray for as we ought, but the Spirit itself makes intercession for us with groanings which cannot be uttered. I was looked to by my family to take the lead in all of this. I had to pick up the torch, so to speak, but I was still sick, and my mind was in a whirlwind with everything that was happening. But through continual prayer, things began to happen. God took that burden off of my shoulders. Things started taking care of themselves. The right people at the right time came into our lives, from brethren to people I've never met before but wanted to give sound advice based on their experiences, to doctors and nurses willing to put their jobs on the line and go against CDC protocols, and a doctor who consulted with us and spoke to the hospital on our behalf for absolutely no money. God's unseen hand was clearly in play upon retrospect. Looking back, there were no coincidences. Many of these things just happened, or they fell into our laps. It was all orchestrated clearly, and yet God had one simple ask of us during this time. Trust Him. And that's the basis of my message today. It's trust. And just what is trust, and how is it different than faith? Faith and trust go hand in hand, but they're not quite the same thing exactly. You can't trust if you don't have faith. And the amount of faith you have affects how much you can trust. If one has no faith, then it is absolutely impossible to trust. To understand trust, let's first define what faith is. Turn to Hebrews 11 and verse 1. Hebrews 11 and verse 1. Now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Faith is a substance. Faith is evidence. It's not something we do. It's how we know with complete certainty that God exists. It's proof of a spiritual realm that we cannot see. Yet all that we do exists only because of what we can't see. Keep your finger here for just a moment, and let's flip to Proverbs 3 and verse 5. Proverbs 3 and verse 5. Right over there. Proverbs 3 verse 5. Trust in the Eternal with all your heart, and lean not unto your own understanding. So here we're told to trust God with all our heart. But look at the second half of this verse. Lean not unto your own understanding. Our own understanding. What is our own understanding? It's our five senses. Only what we can see, touch, smell, taste, and hear. So let's flip back to Hebrews 11 and read verse 3. Hebrews 11, verse 3. Through faith we understand that the worlds were framed by the word of God, so that things which are seen were not made of things which do appear. Faith gives us an understanding that everything we see came from something we can't see, which means that the laws of physics that we as physical beings are bound to does not apply to God. What would be completely and utterly illogical in this physical world is completely possible to God, because God is not bound to these laws of this physical universe. Just as a computer programmer is not bound to the rules he sets in a particular set of software he writes. So our five senses will betray us if that's all we're looking to. This is why we must lean on God, trust God, not our own understanding, because God has full command of that which we can't see. It's interesting that God is likened as to a shield by King David in the Psalms. I want to read through a few of these, so let's go ahead and start with Psalms 18 and verse 2. Psalms 18 and verse 2. Psalms 18, verse 2. The Eternal is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer, my God, my strength, in whom I will trust, my buckler and the horn of my salvation and my high tower. Let's go ahead and move down to verse 30, same chapter. Psalms 18, verse 30. As for God, his way is perfect. The word of the Lord is tried. He is a buckler to all those that trust in him. And let's go to Psalms 30 and verse 5. Psalms 30 and verse 5. Every word of God is pure. He is a shield unto them that put their trust in him. And the last one I want to read is Psalms 115, verses 9 through 11. Psalms 115, verses 9 through 11. O Israel, trust thou in the Eternal. He is their help and their shield. O house of Aaron, trust in the Eternal. He is their help and their shield. Ye that fear the Eternal, trust in the Eternal. He is their help and their shield. So we see time and time again, God is our shield. Trust God. Trust our shield. Now, if we remember back to Ephesians 6, when we were told to put on the armor of God, we're specifically told that the shield, we're specifically told what the shield represents. So let's turn to Ephesians 6:16 and let's go ahead and read that. Ephesians 6, verse 16. Above all, taking the shield of faith, wherewith ye shall be able to quench all the fiery darts of the wicked. So we see here that the shield is faith. Yet it's not our faith, it's the faith of Jesus Christ, because he is our shield. And we're told repeatedly to trust him. So let's think about this for a moment in physical terms. A shield is a piece of armor that a soldier uses to protect himself. Yet it is a bit different than a helmet or a breastplate in that it is an active defense. A shield must be lifted up and positioned in the direction of the attack. Not only must that soldier stand up and brace for the impact of the incoming blow, he must be engaged, muscles tensed. A passive attempt at blocking will stagger the soldier, opening him up for an attack. So a soldier must trust his shield with his life. If a soldier does not believe his shield will protect him, he won't use it. If a soldier doesn't use his shield, he will be struck. We, being soldiers of Christ, must rely heavily on our shield and use it. I think it's also interesting to note that in Psalms 18, buckler is used instead of shield. So a buckler is a type of shield, but it's typically very small, meaning that there's a lot less room for error. It's even more critical for the defender that is using a buckler to position his buckler accordingly to absorb the blow. Just having a buckler doesn't do much, even less so than a large shield, unless it is actively used. Only then can it protect you. So a shield without effort put into it, it's a worthless defense. Just as faith without works, faith without trust is a dead faith. Both result in a dead soldier. I want to read a few excerpts from two different sermons by Mr. Armstrong that really drive home this point. And Mr. Armstrong is much more eloquent with his words than I am. The first is from a sermon titled, What is Faith? Open quote. But putting all the scriptures on the subject of saving faith together, we learn that there are two kinds of faith. And the kind that so blindly trusted in by the majority of this day is nothing but a dead faith. A dead faith never will save one soul. Notice James 2 verse 20. Faith without works is dead, just a dead faith. James continues, was not Abraham our father justified by works when he had offered Isaac his son upon the altar? Seest thou how faith wrought with his works, and by works was faith made perfect? Ye see that by works a man is justified, and not by faith only. James 2, verses 21 through 24. Then we are saved by works instead of faith? No, never. We are saved by faith. But faith functions with our works, and by works our faith is made perfect. That is living faith. With men, it is impossible, utterly impossible, to really keep his commandments. But here's the blessed truth. With God, it is possible even to keep his commandments. Do you begin to see? It takes faith, faith in the power of God. And just as your own diligent effort coupled with faith makes faith perfect, so faith coupled with your effort makes perfect obedience. The two go hand in hand. You cannot have one without the other. A living faith is the only kind that will save, is an active faith, one that trusts God to make it possible to obey Him, to live the true Christian life, to keep His blessed commandments. End quote. This second excerpt is a small one from the sermon titled, We Are the Temple. For context, Mr. Armstrong is speaking of what God would have given Adam had he taken from the tree of life. Open quote. The next thing God would have given him is faith, the faith of Christ, the faith of God, so he could rely on God, because man was going to get in a lot of trouble regardless, even if he is righteous, because Psalm 34:19 says, Many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivers him out of them all. And you need faith to trust God to deliver you in trouble, because you're going to get into trouble, and you need something to trust God to do it. End quote. So we can clearly see the distinction between faith and trust. Trust is the effort we put into faith. We can believe all we want. Satan and the demons, they believe. But if we don't trust God, then faith means nothing. So it is a requirement of God that we trust Him. So let's turn to Joshua 1 and verse 9. Joshua 1 and verse 9. Joshua 1 verse 9. Have I not commanded you, be strong and of good courage? Do not be afraid nor dismayed, for the Eternal, your God, is with you wherever you go. So in as many words, this is essentially God saying, trust me. I am your shield. I will protect you. Don't be afraid. That's a command. Don't be afraid. He is our spiritual father, and he wants his children to trust him. I bet you parents out there want your children to trust you. To trust that you have their best interests at heart, to trust that you will protect them, to trust that you'll provide, to trust that you'll be there for them always, that you are their security blanket, that they can always rely on you to help them out of a crisis or a hard time. If they didn't trust you, that would hurt. It would be disappointing. Most children are inherently born with a trust in their parents. And I think it parallels the spiritual side of things as well, since in order for us to be born into the family of God, we must have an active faith. We cannot become God beings if we don't trust our Heavenly Father. And faith gives us no reason to not trust God. I remember visiting some friends a year ago. It might have been 2 years now. And I'm sure they're listening to this message right now. But I'd often observe the dynamic between them and their two small boys at the time. And I could always see the crossover to how God deals with us being His children. And it was just before Sabbath services this one time that their youngest had been given a new play rug to sit on during services. And he was so happy, and he couldn't wait to lay on it. But just before services began, the father saw that the blanket was slippery, and it slid all over the floor, making it this potential hazard, a danger for his son. So the father took the blanket away and provided the old blanket. The son didn't understand, and he was hurt that his daddy took away his brand new blanket, and he cried. And after being comforted by his father, he trusted that his dad did it for his own good, even though he still didn't quite understand. It was his father, and he will always trust his dad, even if it hurts. So go ahead and turn with me now to Matthew 18 and verse 3. Matthew 18 and verse 3. Verily I say unto you, except ye be converted and become as little children, ye shall not enter into the kingdom of heaven. We have to be like children. Jesus was explaining that to receive Christ's kingdom, a person must be as or like a little child in attitude, humble, faithful, teachable, unpresumptuous, or God will not accept him. A Christian must yield to and trust his spiritual father for everything as a small child does his physical parents. Trust isn't optional. It's crucial to overcoming trials and danger. I don't believe for one second my dad would have survived if left in the hands of the medical establishment. It took an act of crying out to God from all of us, an act of faith, a trust that God would deliver him out of this trial by whatever means he so chooses, whether that be a miraculous healing or using people to fulfill his will. Putting complete trust in God can be scary in certain situations. The scarier the situation, the more faith that is required that can allow us to trust God. I think to the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So let's go ahead and turn to Daniel. And in Daniel chapter 3, we read about King Nebuchadnezzar's decree that at the sound of musical instruments, all must bow down and worship his golden image, or else they would be thrown into a furnace. So it was made known to the king that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego would not do this. So they were brought before him, and he told them point blank that if they didn't worship that image, he was going to kill them. Probably a very painful death, being burned alive in a furnace. I can't even imagine. So let's go ahead and pick it up in verse 16, and let's see how they answered. Daniel 3, in verse 16. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If that is the case, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up. So notice their answer. They tell King Nebuchadnezzar that God is able to deliver them from the furnace. They give God full credit in acknowledging his power, but in verse 18, they acknowledge the will of God, saying, but if not, there was no guarantee that God would save them. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego all had complete faith in the power of God, but they trusted God's will. Whatever became of them, whether that be rescue or death, they trusted God's decision. Their faith made it possible to trust God, to obey God, no matter what, even upon pain of death. This was almost a certain death situation, yet God did come through for them. Last week, we heard the sermon from Mr. Bowles, and he pointed out the first part of Job 13, verse 15. Just that first part, Job 13, 15. Though he slay me, yet will I trust in him. That part, that first part of verse 15, is the correct attitude and outlook. The outcome of the situation is irrelevant. We must trust God's will regardless of whatever happens to us, even if it means death. And that takes extraordinary, extraordinary amounts of faith. Another certain death situation was in Exodus. So imagine coming to a dead end, nothing but sea in front of you and the Egyptian horde behind you closing in. 600 of Pharaoh's best chariots and all the chariots in Egypt. And Pharaoh himself filled with rage and bloodlust. According to all human logic and reasoning, based on the five senses, there is but one outcome: complete annihilation, a massacre. The Israelites had no faith, they had no trust, they had fear, and they had panic because they didn't trust God. But could you blame them? How would we feel if we were in that situation? But let's read Exodus 14, starting in verse 13, what Moses had to say to Israel. Exodus 14, verse 13. And Moses said to the people, "Do not be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall see again no more forever. The Lord will fight for you, and you shall hold your peace." God was their shield. All they needed to do was stand still, be calm, hold their ground, and God would protect them. To stand in awe of the great power of God. How many situations have we been in, brethren, where the situation looks completely hopeless? That based on the things, based on all things logical and human reasoning, there could be no positive outcome. Do we panic? Do we flee? Do we curse God? Or do we stand fast and trust that our God will deliver us out of that situation? That no matter the outcome, it is God's will that is done. One thing that I was thinking about as well was, what if there was no Pharaoh's army in pursuit? What if the Israelites got to the Red Sea and God just parted it? Without that immediate danger, how many of them would have elected to not go through the parted sea? Content to just sit things out. Option A, walk through two towering walls of water, trusting God will keep them there, or stay where they're at. With Pharaoh's army entered into the equation, the choice becomes much more clear. This event was recorded as an example for us today. I think it's all but certain we will face a Red Sea moment. The threat will be there, and the choice will be clear. Trust God or perish, essentially. The story of David and Goliath is interesting to me when it comes to trusting God. David wasn't, he was not a big man. He wasn't a mighty warrior. He was a shepherd. Yet he had an unshakable trust in God, an absolute childlike trust that God would deliver him from any threat. Maybe some of you remember in school as kids, we would tell each other, "My daddy can beat up your daddy." Well, maybe that was just my school, but I want to paint this picture of Goliath. In 1 Samuel 17, we're given some information about Goliath. Verse 4 of 1 Samuel 17, we're told, "Goliath was 6 cubits in one span, which is just under 10 feet tall." Now, I want to give some perspective here. The tallest player in the NBA history was Suleiman Ali Nashmush at 8 feet. So Goliath would dwarf the tallest NBA player in history by almost 2 feet. Not to mention, these guys that play in the NBA that are that tall tend to be very gangly and not well built. They're kind of stretched out. They're not thick and muscle bound. It says that he wore a coat of bronze mail weighing 125 pounds, about the same weight as an average adult female. The shaft of his spear was heavy and thick as a weaver's beam. A weaver's beam was a strong, long, rounded wooden pole used at the top of a loom to hold the vertical thread, and it was usually about 2.5 inches thick. Now, I don't know if you can imagine gripping something that's 2.5 inches thick, but it's hard to grip something that wide unless your hands are massive. And the spearhead weighed 15 pounds. Have you ever gone bowling? Did you use the 16-pound bowling ball? That's as heavy as they go. How far do you think you could throw that? And this was at the tip of a spear. So for the spear to not be unbalanced, it had to weigh more than 15 pounds if the spearhead alone was 15. So we're talking maybe 30-pound spear and trying to throw that. That's one scary human being. Did this scare David? So listen to what David tells King Saul, 1 Samuel 17 and verse 32. So I want to read this from the New Living Translation. 1 Samuel 17 verse 32. "Don't worry about this Philistine," David told Saul. "I'll go fight him." Is there any trepidation? Any sense of fear? Reluctance? None. Why? Why was David so confident? Let's continue in verse 34. But David persisted. "I've been taking care of my father's sheep and goats," he said. "When a lion or a bear comes to steal a lamb from the flock, I go after it with a club and rescue the lamb from its mouth. If the animal turns on me, I catch it by the jaw and I club it to death. I have done this to both lions and bears, and I'll do it again to this pagan Philistine too, for he has defied the armies of the living God. The Lord who rescued me from the claws of the lion and the bear will rescue me from this Philistine." That last verse, verse 37. David trusted God completely. He knew God rescued him in the past when faced with dangerous animals. Now, I'm not sure how big these bears and lions were, but to me, a bear seems way more terrifying than a human being, regardless of how big that human is. You know, just the idea of being mauled with the teeth and the claws, and, you know, you hear about these horror stories of these animals mauling human beings and leaving them, you know, just completely in shreds. So, you know, David had past examples to look back to and see that God always helped him out. He always delivered him from that. So this situation right here is just another day at the office, so to speak. So our ability to trust grows as our faith grows. Now, as we all know, faith isn't something we can muster up. We can't work ourselves up into a fervor of faith. Faith isn't something we can create ourselves. It's the faith of Jesus Christ in us. It's a gift. But God doesn't just give us maximum faith once we receive the Holy Spirit. It's not like after baptism, faith levels go from 0 to 100. It's something that grows inside of us throughout our lives. Let's turn to Matthew 13, and we'll go ahead and read beginning in verse 31. Matthew 13, verse 31. "Another parable he put forth to them, saying, The kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed, which a man took and sowed in his field, which indeed is the least of all the seeds, but when it is grown, it is greater than the herbs and becomes a tree, so that the birds of the air come and nest in its branches." So you have this tiny, insignificant seed, and it hasn't really done anything yet. But within it, there is huge, tremendous potential, potential to grow into a large tree. Now let's go ahead and turn over a few pages to Matthew 17, and we'll start in verse 20. Matthew 17, verse 20. "So Jesus said to them, Because of your unbelief, for assuredly I say to you, if you have faith as a mustard seed, you will say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it will move, and nothing will be impossible for you. However, this kind does not go out except by prayer and fasting." So a mustard seed is not a tree yet, but eventually, given enough time with the right soil, sunlight, water, it will be a tree. Likewise, our faith starting out is pretty insignificant. Yet, as we grow in faith, eventually nothing will be impossible. It just doesn't happen all at once. It takes time to grow. So think about every time we've had an answered prayer. Our faith in God grows. Mine certainly did this past year. I can remember a specific prayer I asked God. It was right after I visited my dad in the ICU for the first time, and he was hooked up to the BiPAP machine. For those of you unfamiliar, it's a machine that forces air into your mouth and nose, and it sucks it back out. He couldn't speak. It was drying his mouth out. His lips and nose were all chapped. It was actually damaging his lungs because the pressure was so high. We had to communicate through text because I couldn't understand him through the mask. He looked so miserable, and I left there feeling so horrible inside for his suffering. And I got on my knees many times that day, and I begged God to get my dad off that machine. The very next day, I went to visit him, and the nurse told me as I was putting on my gown, the gloves and the mask to enter his room, that he had been taken off the BiPAP and put on high-flow oxygen. It was one of the most joyous feelings I had ever had, and I immediately thanked God because I knew he heard and answered all of us crying out to him. My faith grew that day. As our faith grows, so does our ability to trust. Around that time, I had a phone call with Mr. Pippi, he was so calm and so cool and confident in God. No doubt in the world that God would heal Dad. And he made it a point that God wouldn't get Dad to this point only to let him slip away. This was just going to take some time, but God was working things out. All we had to do was sit and wait and trust. This was certainly a life or death situation. It was a nerve-wracking experience, to be sure. But there are going to be even more perilous times in the near future. It's going to get worse. So if we can't trust God on smaller matters, how could we even begin to trust God in a life or death situation? During persecution, that doesn't just result in imprisonment, but in execution, torture. We know that some of us in the Church of God are going to be martyred. It's going to be scary. It's going to be a very scary experience leading up to the Great Tribulation, and downright terrifying for those that must go through it. If we take a look at World War II and the persecution of the Jews back then, compared to what's coming before Christ's return. So I want to go ahead and end with an excerpt from the diary of a young man who lived in Lithuania during World War II. I want to show the horror that this young man experienced. It begins like this. While trying to escape Lithuania, the Ganner family witnessed a horrific massacre, which Sully recounts here. A group of Lithuanian men handed some spades to four Jewish men and told them to dig their own graves. One of them, an elderly man with glasses, froze in terror. A German soldier went up, put a gun to the man's chest. "Pick up that shovel and start digging," he said coldly. When the man did not respond, the soldier shot him. It happened so fast. My mother was so shocked that she cried out loud. Luckily, the condemned Jews cried out at the same time, so no one heard her. She struggled to rise, but my brother Herman forced her down. The remaining three Jewish men hastily began to dig while the Lithuanian men passed around a bottle of vodka and jeered at the Jews. "Well, you lazy Jews, you are all finally doing an honest day's work. Too bad it will be your last." The two Germans stood aside and smoked quite aloof. When they were satisfied that the grave was large enough, they told the Jews to undress. Realizing that their last hour had arrived, some began to cry. Some begged for mercy. Some prayed. The taller German shot one of the diggers, and the rest hastily removed their clothes. We were witnessing the ultimate distress of people who are about to die a violent and shameful death. I will never forget the German's little lecture. He had enunciated clearly, as if giving a speech, and I heard every word. It gave me my first insight to the Nazi killing machine. Then the Lithuanian men began shooting. I closed my eyes and covered my ears, but the terrified screams of the victims, especially those of the children, still haunt my nightmares. I was about to bolt, but Herman held me down, hissing in my ear not to make a sound. My mother fainted. Afterwards, they dragged the trembling farmer Casey's from his house and told him to cover the mass grave with earth. "Next time you try to hide Jews, we'll bury you with them, understand?" The massacre of the people at such close range, where we could see, hear, and smell every minute of it, went through me like a branding iron. I was a normal 13-year-old boy brought up in a sheltered environment, and suddenly I was plunged into a world where anyone could hunt me down and kill me. Something that we really have to think about is, where do we stand with God? And does it take real bullets to start flying to really discover that? If we ever find ourselves in a similar situation, do we trust God? Do we trust God like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? Or do we panic in fear? The experience I had with my father was certainly eye-opening for me. When you're scared, when things are happening fast, when it's an unfamiliar situation you've never been in and you don't know what to do, when death is a factor and it's staring you right in the face, these variables affect how we think in the moment. You can't simulate it. You just can't. We can prepare for it. We get really close to God, as close as we can, forming that deep relationship and trust. Because of smaller things we can look back on in the past and see that God delivered us there and there and there, our ability to trust grows concurrent with the faith of Christ in us. Trust isn't always easy. What is easy is to look at the situation at hand and think all is lost. The Israelites escaped from Egypt, chased by Pharaoh's army. It's a hopeless situation, if not for God's intervention. But we can look back on our own lives. We can look back at other people's lives and look to those situations where God delivered us, where we see God's hand. Mr. Bowles talked about this last week. We have to rely on those experiences and those stories. And that's what's going to help us get through this. Things are going to get really bad. It's going to be scary. And when you get put in a corner and things look bleak, how will we react? Will we throw our hands up in the air? Will we run and cower and panic and be afraid? Or are we going to remember that God is our shield and that we must trust our shield? Trust God and stand in awe.